open. Select your top 10 singles and top 10 albums and EPs released in Kingston this year by local artists, and enter for a chance to win $1,000 in prizes from CFRC and our friends at Long & McQuaid, KPP Concerts, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, The Screening Room, and Black Dog Hospitality. Show your love for local music. Get in on the action today via CFRC.ca, proudly supporting local artists since 1922.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, a queer artist spotlight featuring DJ, drag artist, activist, Alfonso King Jr. That and more next. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, a queer artist spotlight featuring Alfonso King Jr., who you might know as Jade Electra, DJ Relentless, or through his activism. He joins me today to talk about new music, his time in the 1990s New York City voguing scene, and so much more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning best-selling author Michael Bach reads from his latest book, Alphabet Soup, The Essential Guide to LGBTQ2+ Inclusion at Work.
Alphabet Soup is a guide that will take you, my faithful reader, on a journey of discovery with the objective of turning you and your organization into active allies, a term I explain in the book. Like it or not, LGBTQ2+ people need allies to help us achieve that elusive goal of true inclusion. Everything in this book can be applied to a workplace and engaging with employees, as well as interactions with volunteers, customers, students, parishioners, or just everyday people on the street. When it comes to LGBTQ2+ inclusion at work and in communities, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite conversations. Many years ago, I was speaking with the head of HR for an organization located in a Western European country that shall remain nameless to protect the guilty. She was telling me about the company's work in diversity and inclusion, with no mention of work in the LGBTQ2+ communities. When I probed, she defensively explained that they don't discuss, quote, these things, end quote, at work. I looked over at a photo on her desk and asked if the man in it with her was her husband, to which she responded in the affirmative. It was a wedding photo and she was wearing a white wedding dress, so chances were good. I pointed out that the photo was a statement of her sexual orientation. I likely didn't need to ask her what sexual orientation she identified with because she had it on display. I probably should have asked, but let's focus on the point. That was an eye-opening moment for her. Organizations don't think about how much it costs to not create inclusive space for LGBTQ2+ folks. But the price tag can be quite hefty. There's the cost of lower levels of engagement, the cost of higher levels of voluntary turnover, the cost of recruitment, the cost of decreased innovation. And just like when I enter a wine store, that bill can add up fast. So how do you quantify the cost? I spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. Then, around 2005, someone from IBM shared a model with me. The first time I saw it, I thought, this is exactly what I've been trying to explain. And I used it to build a business case for why my employer needed an LGBTQ2+ employee resource group. At the top of the list of issues is the fact that the approach to educating on diversity and inclusion is traditionally one and done. You put everyone through a voluntary program and you're good, right? This is what I like to refer to as wrong. The first mistake is that your employee population isn't static. The average employee turnover rate is about 18%, but that can be a lot higher in some industries, like food service or retail. One food service employer I worked with had a turnover rate of nearly 75% of frontline workers. By the time you've trained everyone, you need to start back at the beginning to capture new people. And that cycle continues endlessly. Education should be part of onboarding. From the day a person starts, there should be mandatory D&I education, obviously with specific LGBTQ2+ content, driven by a D&I learning map that takes each person through a learning journey. The second mistake in the one-and-done approach is the idea that one program covers it all. If Black Lives Matter has shown us anything, it's that we have a lot of work to do to educate people on anti-Black and anti-Indigenous systemic racism. And that's just one topic. The conversation on LGBTQ2+ inclusion is constantly evolving, and so should your education program.
'69 was a big year. It was the year that saw both the Stonewall riots in New York and more or less decriminalization of gay sex in Canada. The following year, the Americans celebrated the anniversary of Stonewall with Christopher Street Liberation Day. That was the summer of 1970. They didn't actually call it Pride at the time. August 1st, 71 was Toronto's first official gay picnic at Hanlon's Point. It was organized by the Community Homophile Association of Toronto and Toronto Gay Action. 300 people showed up. Now, that wasn't officially a pride, but Gerald Moldenhauer, one of the veterans of those days, maintains that a march down Yonge Street a few weeks later should be called the first Toronto Pride. That was a warm-up for the more famous We Demand demonstration in Ottawa, held August 28th that year, a protest against the inadequacies of Trudeau's decriminalization. By the way, if you want to see some pictures of those early days, check out Gerald's website. It's GeraldMoldenhauer.com, and it's spelled GeraldMoldenhauer. The first official Toronto Pride was actually the next year, 1972, again in August. Then there was a second Gay Pride Week, August 17th to 26, 1973. That one was national, not just Toronto. There were events and marches in Vancouver, Saskatoon, Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax. The focus was political, on ending discrimination against queers, something that was still quite legal across the country at the time. Then, the following year, 1974, there was Pride number 3 in Toronto, August 17th. I came out at that one, so I remember it very, very well. We marched over to Queen's Park to again demand human rights protection. And then they stopped. There was nothing in 75. People were focused on a national lesbian and gay conference in Ottawa. And again in 76, all of us in Toronto were busily preparing to host the 4th National Lesbian and Gay Conference, which happened in September. Gay Days was a big festival in 78, but nothing called itself Pride again until 1981 after the Bath Raids. That's where the misconception that Pride began after the Bath Raids comes from. 81, I suppose, is significant because that's when the shift happened from August to the last weekend in June to harmonize with Prides across the U.S. But that's not the first Pride. So when you hear someone say that the first Toronto Pride was in 1981, you should politely point out that that's not quite true. Toronto and other cities in Canada had our own August Prides for almost a decade before that. And there are still those of us around who remember. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, the most recent eliminated designer from Project Runway Canada.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Little Feather, hi. How are you?
I'm great.
Okay, so Little Feather, you are the fourth eliminated designer from Project Runway Canada. Here's my first question for you. Did your elimination, did this come as a surprise to you?
No.
Short and sweet. No. Okay. So your challenge was to create one look and transform it into another, and you had to use a garment from a clothing store, Joe Fresh, and your garment was a vest. When you saw the vest and when you heard of this challenge, what went through your mind? Having to work with a vest.
Oh my God, I got instant brain fog. My OCD kicked in and I could not think beyond the vest. I have this thing with vests where I just don't like them. So having to work with something that I just know I don't like, it was so hard. You know, it was just like, and then when I found out we couldn't alter the essential item, that was even worse for me because I thought, oh, I can make it not a non-vest. But then, yeah, no, it had to be used the same way that it regularly would. So we couldn't alter this essential item. That made it even harder.
Why? Okay, so just going to put it bluntly. Why? Girl, why do you hate a vest?
God, it's so funny too, because after I went on about hating vests, they're everywhere. They're actually in fashion. I think I don't like vests because Aladdin was like one of my favorite movies as a child, and I'm pretty sure Aladdin was like always wearing a vest. So I just not about vests. And not only that, it's kind of, for me, it's kind of like a traditional garment, you know, like, so it's not really traditional now, but in my culture, a lot of people will wear a vest. And it's funny because my dad always bugs me. He wants me to make him a vest. You know, I watched my mom make one, and it's actually really difficult if you want to create the lining with no, you know, if you don't want to show the seam. Mm-hmm. I've just never been a fan of vests. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So having the vest and having, you know, your thing about it, this challenge was such a challenge for you? Why do you think you couldn't, like, you know, maybe push past it or something?
Because the vest, it just clouded my vision, my like everything. It just ended at the vest, and it was just like, I knew, like,
you couldn't see past.
Yeah, it was just like, I was like the end of me. I was just like, oh, mm-hmm. shit.
The odd thing about it was during the judging process, it came to light that one of the judges, the iconic Jeannie Becker, it came to light that she said that she, when she first saw your design, that she would wear something like that. So how does, when she said that, when that came to light, how did that make you feel?
That, like, even right now, it gives me goosebumps. It's really unreal, you know, just the word Jeannie, the name Jeannie Becker is like a really powerful fashion word, you know, everybody in Canada knows.
Fashion television.
That's fashion, right? Mm-hmm. Jeannie Becker, that's like fashion. And then when fashion is saying, you know, they would wear my garment, I'm like... So, yeah, I was super, I felt super proud, validated. I felt like I belong in the fashion industry. Yeah.
Even though this was the challenge that took you out, this was the silver lining.
Well, you know what? I'm telling you, it was the vest. I knew that this freaking vest... was going to take me out. Like, I kind of just accepted it. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, people don't know this, but it was really, really intense. It's really intense to experience creating a garment under such high pressure, you know? And I just felt like it was time. And I just wanted to make something great. But I wanted to go out with great. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to be on Project Runway Canada? Why did you want to put yourself through this pressure cooker, so to speak?
Because I wanted to show the world. That has always been my goal, is to show the world that Indigenous people are creative. Indigenous people are... beautiful, they're creative, and yeah, we have beautiful looks as well.
And diamonds are made from pressure.
Oh my god, yes, exactly.
So your original designs highlights Indigenous culture and turns them into luxe outerwear and bold silhouettes. So how did you, Little Feather, how did you get introduced originally to the world of fashion? How did this all come about for you?
It actually started when I was in kindergarten. I'm not sure how old you are in kindergarten, but, you know, it's the grade before one. And my school back where I'm from, Lakeview School, I was graduating kindergarten. And my mother had created a graduation dress for me. And I remember the bag of fabric. I remember her sewing. And I don't know why, but I wasn't really paying attention to what she was doing. But then I realized, and she was like, try this on. And I'm like, what? And then I put it on. And I remember, like, just the shape of it. And I remember putting it on and I felt like a princess. I felt so, I don't know, I felt like royalty. And I remember the feeling that it gave me. And I remember thinking, like, looking at my mom and thinking, like, you did this? Like, you can do this? And I remember thinking, I want to do this. If my mom can do this, I can do this. And then I remember thinking, you know, like, I want to make people feel a certain way, you know? If you can, you have the power to create something, to make somebody feel something, you know, I feel like that's meaningful. Like, it's a lasting impression.
Well said.
And it's one that they can keep, right?
Here's my last question for you, little feather, and it's simply this. Best part about being part of Project Runway Canada.
Oh, the question is, what is the best part?
Yeah, what's been the best part for you about being part of this whole process?
The best part was not only meeting all of the creative, deadly designers right here in our home, Canada, but also being able to have this forever friendship with Del Rumic and being able to join together and show the world, you know, Indigenous people know fashion and Indigenous people are brave. And I feel like that's exactly what we did.
Well said, well said. Little Feather, well said. Well done, well designed. Thanks for your time and thanks for being on the show. Well done to you.
Thank you.
By the way, new episodes of Project Runway Canada drops on Fridays and streams on Crave. Up next, a queer artist spotlight.
I'm Skye Gilbert, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
Alfonso King Jr., hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I am well. I have to say thank you for coming back to Rainbow Country. Let's start here. You wear many hats, Alfonso King Jr. You are a DJ, you are a producer, an actor, a vocalist, an activist, a spouse. You also have a few names, DJ Relentless, Jade Electra, Alfonso King Jr. Also, too, in my humble gay opinion, a history, I think, would apply to yourself because my understanding is back in the day, the 90s, you were part of the ballroom scene in New York City, the voguing scene. Mm-hmm. Take me back to that time in your life and how were you part of the ballroom scene, the voguing scene, in that pivotal time of, like, gay culture?
Well, in 1992, I moved to New York City. I was kind of escaping Tampa, Florida, because I didn't want my family to know that I was HIV positive. So I moved to New York. And my very first job was in a place called Sally's, which is actually featured in Paris is Burning. And I landed in the middle of what was left of the cast of Paris is Burning. So I worked with Dorian Corey. I worked with Angie Extravaganza. I was the DJ for them at this club. And the person who took me in was a queen named the Electrifying Grace. She wasn't well. and we had a benefit for her. And so I was mentioning to Dory and Corey that I did drag, and she was like, well, you should do something for this benefit. So she made me an outfit, which I still have. I performed, and Pepa LaBeija was at that benefit. And she saw me and she called me over afterwards. And she goes, you remind me of myself when I was younger. How would you like to be in the house of LaBeija? And I was like, oh my God, yes. So I didn't have to walk a ball. I didn't, you know, I was just inducted into the house because of Pepa liked me. But I didn't stay in it for very long. I probably was in it for maybe about 6 months because I realized that I wasn't as competitive as everyone else. Like the ballroom scene is your life when you join it. So you're working towards the next ball. And I had aspirations of doing other things. I wanted to act. I wanted to make music. I wanted to be a DJ. And those things were just, they would have taken up more time to be in the ballroom scene. So I left it. So it's not like I was a legend in the House of LaBeija or anything like that. I was only in it for a short time. But for the time that I was, I did walk several balls. I won some trophies because of the people had never seen me. So they put me up for Butch Queen first time in drags at a ball. And because they'd never seen me before, they would be like, oh my God, you know, he looks great. So that was the extent of it. I know it doesn't sound as glamorous as, but I did end up working for a lot of the ball scene because of DJed for many balls. And I also started creating music, which was used for it, like the bitch tracks that I did as Jade Electra.
So looking back today, from where you are today, back then, what's the takeaway? What, when you look back on your time then, what comes to mind? What do you take from that period of time and still use to this day?
Well, I mean, you know, coming from Tampa, Florida, where there wasn't a scene of color. So if you were out, you were going out with everyone. The scene was so small there that everyone had to share the dance floor. So everybody, Leathermen, drag queens, were all on one dance floor because there were only a few bars. Going to New York and finding a community of color and really learning to appreciate being Black. I'm actually Black and Latino, but like just finding a community where I wasn't different and I was actually accepted. And that was the most important part of going to New York for me. And the drag queens who took me under their wings, Pepa LaBeija, Dorian Corey, Paris Dupree, who is in the film, but they didn't do her interview because she was demanding money before the movie got released. So they cut her and she bitched about it all the way to her death. And New York was the best lesson for me and also the best move for me because of it actually showed me that I could survive on my own. So that time period was really, really important. And I got to do so many things because once I started auditioning for film and television, I also got to travel. Like I had never left the country before. So I got to go to Rome and London. It was amazing. I signed a record deal over in London. They were going to make me, they were trying to make me into their version of RuPaul, but unfortunately 9/11 happened and their business offices were in the Twin Towers. And that kind of ended the deal. I had an album that was just being held. So eventually I got the rights back to everything and I released the album just a couple of years ago and it's called Legendary Darling. But yeah, all of my stuff was tied up with this label and the publishing and all that stuff. So all that got fixed and I was able to get my stuff back, but my material had been floating around on the internet and Napster was a big problem for me because it put out a lot of my stuff without me getting to say yay or nay about either.
So that was then. This is now. You have a new single with platinum-selling artist Simone Denny called Let's Call It Love. Talk to me about this collaboration. First of all, how did this collaboration come about?
I had been trying to work with her for a while, actually for almost a decade. I was working with a producer and performer named Brian Greenwood, who used to go by Divinesque. And we were the Snatch Sisters back then. We were doing the Pride scene and traveling places and performing together. And he was a producer, and he happened to have some vocals left over for something that he had recorded with her. And I was like, oh, I like those. It had a good hook to it. So we recorded a song called The Realness. Now, ironically, my career as a recording artist has always kind of paralleled with RuPaul and Ru, actually, which is bizarre. Shortly after we recorded our song, had a song called The Realness. I approached Simone and asked her about doing it. Well, her manager at the time was like, oh yeah, you can use the vocals or whatever, you just have to pay us about like $1,000-something. And I was like, I'm a poor person living in the ghetto, I don't have any money I don't have money like that. So so we couldn't release the song. But I started running into Simone at different events and different things, so we became friends. And we kept talking about, we should collab on something, we should write something or whatever. But she's a busy, busy girl. She is constantly like being flown here and there to go perform. They love her over in the UK. They love her over in Ireland. She is constantly going. We talk about it and it never happened. But this last year, during the summer, she was like, we really need to get on this. And so we literally wrote the song together over Zoom. We went over, my producer, Eric Elias, did a track and sent it to us. And so we just started listening to it and trying to work out lyrics, and we did it. Once we got those down, I got her in the studio and, she recorded it. And, I had no intentions of being on the track, but she was like, you know, you need to be on this. You help write it, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I took the microphone and I sang some parts of the backup for her, but the hook of Let's Call It Love, I decided, I got the idea from another track, an old 90s track, where JoJo America spoke, and it was Gimme Love. So I was like, oh, you know, I should do something like that. So I just spoke in my normal voice in a low register, and I was like, Let's Call It Love. We used it on the track, and that became part of the hook. That's how it came about. And we got signed to Matt Moss's label, Vitan Music. And, the rest is history, I guess. We have some new remixes by Dirty Disco out of Texas. Matt did some mixes, and I'm hoping that we'll get one more or two more mixes done. I just spoke to Simone the other day about us doing a music video, so hopefully we can get that done soon.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Keegan Hurst, former professional rugby player, coach, raving homosexual, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tarrant.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bobcats, An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
My name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi. I'm Joey Lamar, best-selling author of Mambo Lips and Salsa Hips, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So Alfonso King Jr., we're talking all about you. Let's talk about you as a DJ, DJ Relentless. My understanding is you have a new night at the Black Eagle in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about what audiences, what dancing feet can expect at your night at the Black Eagle in Toronto. First of all, what day of the week is it? And is there a name for the night?
Yes, it's Sundays from 4 to 8. I wanted to bring back the early tea dance because, you know, in the old days, I remember when tea dances started at 2 p.m. And the twist for mine is it's video. It's all music video. So you actually can come in and relive the good old days of the 70s and 80s. But it's called Video Jukebox. So you can actually request things. So, and you can request something current also. So it's not just the oldies, it can be anything. So the music can go in any direction. It's an open format. And we want to create a place where everyone is welcome. I think that the Eagle has a reputation of just being a man's bar, but actually anyone is welcome. Women, drag queens, trans people, everyone is welcome. And that's the vibe, I guess. Coming from Tampa, Florida, where everyone had to share the dance floor, that's been my goal ever since I've been a DJ, is to have everyone on the floor. So we just started, and the first one went very well. A couple of things real quick. As Jade Electra, I host a game show called Thought You Knew, which happens on the second Thursdays of each month. And it's a trivia game show, so everyone is welcome. We prefer 18 and up because we do cover some adult subjects and trivia. Also, every third Tuesday of each month, I do Pink Cinema, and that is my movie night. That's also a free event. And if you join our Facebook group, you can vote on what movie we are going to see. We discuss the movie after whatever movie it is afterwards, and we pick the next theme for the next month.
Where are these things happening?
One more, and then I'll give you the place. Mingle is our monthly fundraiser for different ASOs, AIDS organizations with services. And that happens on the third Thursday of each month. All of these events happen at the PWA building at 163 Queen Street East. They're on the first floor in the community hub. It's a beautiful space. During the summer, we've been enjoying their patio, but, you know, the weather is changing. It's a great space. This new building that they moved into a couple of years ago is amazing. I'm finally glad that I found a space where I can create things and actually give back to the community. And the way that I like doing is like creating events, because of a lot of people who are living with HIV get taken down by depression. That's one of the biggest killers of people with HIV. So building a community where they can come and have experiences of, you know, entertainment and all of that stuff. And also welcoming in other people as allies. So people who aren't HIV positive, please come down and show your support. It's a free event. So
we're talking about you as an artist, you as a DJ, you also act, although this next project that's done and out isn't necessarily you acting, but CANFAR, the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, just did and released their first film, a short film called Still Here. It's a documentary. Talk to me essentially about what this short documentary Still Here is about.
The big topic right now on the HIV AIDS scene is aging. I know that they didn't plan for us to still be alive. So that's the main goal right now, is getting people to realize that, like, we need to start making plans for seniors who are living with HIV and put things in place. During the pandemic, I was on several panels for an organization called Realize, and I actually host a symposium about aging. And I learned so much of what seniors go through, not just like people living with HIV, but like in senior homes, if you're a couple, they will separate you. They don't want you to actually have sex, with something that I had no clue about. There's all kinds of things. There's nothing in place for people who are living with HIV. So, and the majority back in 2020 and 2021, the majority of the people who were talking in these groups were talking about how badly LGBT people are treated in senior living, because the majority of the nurses are from the Caribbean, and that, you know, their take on gay people is, you know, it's wrong. So a lot of people were being mistreated. So we started raising our voices and talking about how these things need to change. There needs to be a protocol, and also that there's a need for senior homes that are built for LGBT people. So, I turned 58 this year, and I always joke that I'm on a banana peel sliding towards 60. So I need to start worrying about these things and what retirement looks like for seniors, especially who are living with HIV, because you need to be prepared for that transition, to get your meds and your care and all that stuff. So.
Yeah. So talk to me about your activism then. Why is activism, why does that speak to you? Why is that important for you to be active?
Well, I think my activism here in Toronto started because of when I first got here. I wasn't a citizen. I wasn't a permanent resident. I was married to a Canadian, but like I couldn't work. I couldn't, you know, not legitimate work. PWA was the place that we had to go to get services and to get food at certain points because of, you know, I live in public housing. And so my activism actually started with PWA. I wanted to give back. I felt like I needed to participate and help others. And also looking at the scene, there wasn't a, there was a group that was called Out and Pause, but technically they weren't. They were kind of meeting in secret. They had a secret list of their members and they would meet at Bumpkins for dinner. And, but like, it was, it wasn't out, like where other people could learn about it or know or come and see. So my husband and I started Pause.to, and that started at Good Handies. That's how long ago it was, before they turned into Club 120. We were doing this monthly party called Pause.to. And I wanted something that was out and proud about being HIV positive because of, we have to fight stigma. And that's been the main goal, is fighting stigma. If we cannot fight stigma hiding in a closet. So I really put myself out there. And my husband and I came out in Fab magazine about being HIV positive in their couples column. But I really wanted to kind of shake things up because if I didn't see anyone else really being very vocal about being HIV positive. So that was the goal.
I should just say that when you say PWA, that's People with AIDS Foundation in based in Toronto. So how have you found that, that like dealing with that stigma and trying to erase that stigma? I know that there's that campaign, U equals U, meaning undetectable equals untransmittable mm-hmm. When it comes to individuals living with HIV and on medication. But how have you found trying to erase and alleviate stigma around HIV and AIDS? How has that been for you?
Well, actually, it's been really good, and it's actually taking me very far because I am very vocal about my being positive. The liberating thing, I know that not everyone can come out about their status. Some people, they don't because of their family or the religious beliefs or whatever. But I always say that you need people like me who are going to be out and talk freely. And I did a residency at the University of Toronto in the Queer and Trans Research Lab, talking about community leadership and teaching how I took an intern under my wing for the whole semester, for the school year, and showed her how, I put together all of my events, how I do the fundraising, all of that stuff. So hopefully some of that will brush off on some of the younger people that like, oh, this is very important to give back to our community. And I always say, as long as I am helping others, I will never be hungry. I will never be I'm trying to do something for other people, and other people always end up helping me in return. So, I don't find it to be that hard anymore. I feel like I've already told everyone. So there's nothing that they can say that's going to be damaging or hurting. I'm not single, so I'm not on the dating sites trying to pick up anyone. But I know that there is a major stigma that goes on. And one of the other big problems, and a lot of HIV positive people hate when I say this, but I say it everywhere, there's a big problem of gay men who are HIV positive pretending that they're on PrEP instead of being out about their status. And that's one of the problems of PrEP for me, is that like it's creating this false narrative I'm on PrEP, so you know that makes it extra safe. If you're undetectable, you're undetectable and you can't transmit it, and that's what we should be saying and talking about. But there are tons of people who are still, they have their own problems and they self-inflict stigma upon themselves. I don't have that, and I don't have to worry about that.
You're mentioning earlier that You're originally from Tampa, Florida. And you recently became a Canadian citizen.
Yes, I did.
Welcome. How has that been for you, having dual citizenship now?
It's great.
I'm assuming you have dual citizenship. I don't think you rejected your American.
But I'm pretty close to it, trust me. It's been great. People ask me, well, why did it take so long or whatever? For the longest time, I did not want to have to take the test. I'm really horrible at tests. I get so nervous about them, and I always feel like I'm going to screw them up. And it did not help that I have a husband who is a jokester. So he would tell me all kinds of things like, oh, yeah, you know, you got to learn all 13 provinces and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, my God, how am I going to learn all this stuff? And so during the pandemic, my citizenship or my permanent residency expired, and it was so hard to get it renewed. So finally last year I got to go and speak with someone who could help me do the application and all that stuff. She was like, why haven't you, applied? And I said, well, I'm really afraid of taking the test and blah, 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 blah. And she goes, you're over 55. You don't have to take a test. You just pay the money. And I was like, what? And as soon as I got the money together, I went and paid the money, did the application. And I did that in July of last year. And I came through in April 14th of 2025.
Well said. Well done to you. Well, I have to say, Jade Electra, DJ Relentless, Alfonso King Jr., thank you for your time. Thank you for everything that you're doing, having your voice be out there. Thank you for the music and for the activism. And thank you for your time being on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was my spotlight on DJ, drag artist, and activist, Alfonso King Jr. You can find his music on your favorite streaming service. By the way, you can watch for free the new CANFAR documentary, Still Here. Simply visit canfar.com/still-here.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
The phone rings. I get a message from the mayor. He's going to call me back the next day. I get the call, and he said, if you'd accept, we'd like to honor you with the key to the city. There was an event later that year in May. Just a key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but it's history. So a reporter wants to talk to me and says, You know, well, so it's key, right? Like, what's the big deal? I said, well, not everybody gets the key. So I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, Simone Denny featuring Jade Electra. Let's call it love.
Let's call it love.
Yeah.
CFRC 101.9 FM, the Kingston Music Office, and our sponsors, Long & McQuaid and Modern City Taxi, are pleased to announce the 2025 Release Radar Listenership Survey is now open. Select your top 10 singles and top 10 albums and EPs released in Kingston this year by local artists, and enter for a chance to win $1,000 in prizes from CFRC and our friends at Long & McQuaid, KPP Concerts, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, The Screening Room, and Black Dog Hospitality. Show your love for local music. Get